Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 310, we are back with a preview of the September 2021 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician is published online and in print. You can find it online at retinalphysician.com. We cover a variety of topics in this panel discussion. We spend a lot of time talking about the pros and cons of 360-degree laser retinopexy or laser to the vitreous basin or serrata during retinal detachment repair. We then move on to discussion of management of large refractory macular holes, especially in the setting of myopia. We then talk a little bit about a custom iris prosthesis and end with the discussion of imaging biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. As always, you can find a list of financial disclosures for all participants in this episode. You can also find a link to claim CME credits on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with another edition of a journal club. This is a retinal physician-based journal club. So remember, Retinal Physician published online every 1 to 2 months, accessible in print and also at retinalphysician.com. We're previewing the September 2021 edition of Retinal Physician, a few articles. And joining me for this podcast, a couple of new faces, a couple new names, but we'll start with the well-known one. Nick Farber is joining us from Tallahassee. Nick, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
We got Akshay Thomas, who's from Memphis, Tennessee. Akshay, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Trey.
And David Chu.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, actually, Nick, you guys didn't say you were excited to be here. That's 1 point to David. We're playing the around the horn game. David gets a plus one from the stat boy over here. Okay, so we're going to cover a couple of these articles. Again, the goal is not here to cover the articles in exhaustive detail. You can read them on your own, but we're going to use them as jumping off points for discussion. First thing, we have an article. I actually was co-authored on it. That's not why I want to bring it up first. I want to bring it up first because I'm curious to hear the group's thoughts on it. So it's about 360 laser retinopexy for primary retinal detachment. This was in Controversies in Care. The article itself didn't end up being very controversial. So the way this worked is Dr. Ed Ryan from Minnesota and I were both independently asked to write our thoughts on 360 laser for RDs. And then we both wrote our sections. And then later, looking at both of our sections, although they're written differently and stylistically, they're kind of very similar approaches where neither of us is necessarily the biggest fan of 360 laser routinely, although we both agree there are scenarios where you may want to use 360 laser. And we can go into pros and cons, but let's just jump right into discussions. David, when I sent you guys this article, the first thing you said is, oh, this is great because I published the paper showing that maybe we should do this and I'm in favor of doing this. Give us your arguments and data for why you think people should do 360 laser during detachment surgery.
Well, first of all, I don't really have any data to share with you, but I think for me, I like to do 360 laser for pseudophakes. I think it's an old idea. I think that has fallen out of favor in recent times as people have felt more confident in their ability to explore the peripheral retina and inspect for any last breaks. But for me, I think, I come in from the angle of being in a training institution. There are fellows doing the cases. I think that you can't get that same level of visualization unless you're the person scleral depressing. So I have seen instances where missed breaks were the cause of redetachments. I think that is, you know, the biggest shame in the world. And I think it's very easy for that to happen in pseudophakic breaks where they're anterior and small. And so for pseudophakes, my preferred practice pattern is 360 laser. In phakics, I tend not to necessarily rely on that unless there's so many breaks that, you know, it's just connecting the dots, as was stated in the article. I think, Jay, you said that, because I tend to do a buccal vit for phakic patients anyway, so you do get that support there.
So it's interesting you ended on that point because the argument that I immediately go to the devil's advocate argument, because there's data actually suggesting that phakic patients who get a primary vitrectomy have a higher redetachment rate than pseudophakic patients. So the argument would be if you're going to 360 laser your pseudophakes, then you probably should also 360 laser your phakic patients. But actually, I'm going to come back to you, David, to finish that point. If you weren't not doing a buccal vit in a phakic patient, would you do 360 laser, or is it selection bias? Because at that point, that patient is essentially so, quote unquote, in your mind, low risk, you're just treating the breaks.
Yeah, so there probably are some specific instances where I'm not doing a scleral buccal at those instances. I think that for me, I come from the angle not of necessarily like, I don't truly believe, well, let me just say this. No, I mean, the most important thing is just finding the breaks and treating the breaks. And I think in a phakic detachment with or without a scleral buckle, generally the breaks are just horseshoe tears. They're easy to find. I don't see the additional protection against unseen missed breaks. So I don't usually do that. Now, I think the second point, I think that anecdotally for me, I kind of, and I realize that the data is there, but I think that, you know, these are not well-controlled studies. I think a lot of this data is retrospective and surgeon dependent. We all know the limitations here, but I personally anecdotally feel like 360 laser can reduce the risk of redetachment due to PVR itself. It foreshortens the retina, creates a pseudo-retinectomy, creates that aura segunda type of effect. And when you have a redetachment, that still does happen in a pseudophake with 360 laser, you see that that anterior retina has been pexied down. So you almost have created that retinectomy for yourself, decrease the path length for contractile forces associated with PVR. So I like that.
I love this. This is so much more controversial in the article because I am chomping at the bit to disagree with what you just said with no data to back up what I'm about to say. But Akshay, let's get your thoughts on 360 laser.
Well, so I'll preface this by when I started my first year in practice, I changed pretty much nothing about how I did things in fellowship. So most of my phakic patients were either primary buckles or buckle vits. And at least in fellowship, whenever we threw a buckle on and did a buckle vit, for the most part, we did 360 laser. And if we had a pseudophakic patient that we did a vit on, we just pexied the break. I at the moment tend to just treat the breaks. Especially if I have a buckle on in the sense that I know I've gotten the peripheral vitreous much better in a phakic patient with a buckle on than without a buckle. And I'd add to kind of counter David's point, you know, I think that I use like a scrub nurse, right, that may change, you know, from day to day. And I'd venture to say that as a fellow, I'd like to think I depressed better than they did. So I think my confidence in my shave is probably even lower than if I had a fellow operating and I was depressing for them, or if I was, or if they were depressing for me. But on average, I tend to only use 360 laser in a handful of cases, like total detachments that are pseudophakic. And I think they might have a couple of small breaks that I just don't recognize.
Nick Farber, what say ye?
I'm going to split the difference. So I do use 360, I know, even the best right in the middle. I do use 360 laser. Even in the article, they come up with reasons when to use it. Giant retinal tears, if you have lattice almost 360 degrees, yeah, if you have pathology in each quadrant, if you're connecting the dots. And so you're almost selecting already for those cases that are more likely to redetach. And so all of these studies are prospective studies. None of these studies are prospective studies. Even the PRO study itself is a retrospective study because we can't, you know, surgical studies are inherently difficult. You cannot match in an equal group on opposite side and then, you know, go forth and say, this break at 12 o'clock with fluid in the macula is the same as this break at 6 o'clock, or these two breaks temporally, and what kind of tamponade are you using? And it's, you know, that's why big data can be helpful because you're aggregating. But even the PRO study said 21% in here favored 360 laser. But that didn't quite correlate to, because the PRO study did say that surgical outcomes, the incidence of redetachment was higher with 360 laser. It's still retrospective. So, you know, even then, those surgeons felt like it was necessary in those cases. So you're still predisposing in those cases. I think the main point that gets brought up that I want to stick to is it's how you do the laser. Are these small white hot burns, or are these more of the gray? Are you doing three concentric circles and you're connecting all those dots? Or Dr. Ryan also mentioned he likes to laser in the area of the detachment. So if it's a total detachment, he's doing this anyways. Is that a PRP style laser? Or is that this concentric white hot burn? Not white hot, but are you using continuous laser? He mentions he specifically wants gray. So I don't mean to suggest Dr. Ryan uses white hot. And I think that matters a lot. And so to me, this really came down to, it still looks like surgeon preference. It's how you do the laser. And even in these studies, they're still backing into it when the situation demands, which is, of course, anecdotal evidence, which is kind of our lowest tier of evidence. And I don't think we'll have an easy answer to this. I think that those who advocate for laser downplay the risks of laser, and those who advocate for buckles will downplay the risk of buckles when it comes to it. And so you can certainly have positives and negatives with both, and you're going to see redetachments with both.
Yeah, that's really well said. And we're going to circle back to David in a sec. I mean, I think that I was asked this question by the fellow today while we were doing an oil removal procedure and just chatting about 360 laser, because I added some 360 laser during the oil removal. And I don't do that routinely, but there's some data suggesting that it's not a bad idea. And that's a completely different conversation. We can get into that if you guys want. But in terms of treating those redetachments or what you do when they have a re-op, then maybe you become a little more aggressive. And Nick, or as you said, you select out the higher risk cases when you do the primary surgery. How you do something is really important, David, right? So I think you and I are aligned, maybe all four of us are aligned in how this should be, quote unquote, should be done. I mean, not hot burns. I like to use a continuous laser, but I usually don't paint with it. I'll use spots. So it's kind of the equivalent of like a long duration repeat laser with these large kind of spots. And I usually do 2 to 3 rows if I'm doing 360. And my big thing I try to tell people is I try to get the vitreous base, but take it out to aura. So and the hard part comes, what happens when you have a really, really posterior vitreous base? What do you do with that anterior retina? Well, if it's buckled, I don't feel as compelled that I need to laser on it 360. And I'm curious if any of you feel strongly that you need to do 360 laser if you already have a good scleral buckle and encircling band in there. But if there is not a buckle for whatever reason, then I might consider taking the laser out to aura, even if it's an extra row or two. I don't like to leave that band, because I think the reason, Nick, you said that people, that laser gets a bad rap, right? So there's people like, I hate 360 laser. Well, why do they hate it? They hate it because they've seen donut detachments. They've seen people do a 360 laser in the mid periphery, and there's these big RDs peripherally. They've seen bad inflammation ERMs, and they associate with the laser. But is it from the laser or from having breaks in every quadrant and RPE cells? But I do agree, 360 laser is not benign. So it's interesting to kind of, I don't think you would ever be at fault if you did it, quote unquote, properly, of doing 360 laser almost every non-buckle case. Or just having a really, really low threshold to do it. And I think the cases I have the lowest threshold are going along with David said, are the pseudophakes, especially the higher myope pseudophakes, where you might be on the fence whether you should maybe add a buckle because you know their vitreous base is a little abnormal. But I'll usually approach them as a bit. I mean, the vitreous base really looks that abnormal, and add kind of 360 laser. Now, and David, you can add thoughts on what anyone else said, but I'm going to go back to your point about PVR, because I think that is a huge discussion. Is does the laser prevent PVR? Does it make it worse? And then let's say it has no contribution to PVR. Does it make your job easier or harder when you go back? And I think, obviously, we're biased anecdotally. I think that I'm actually biased in cases where it's your higher risk for PVR, not the throw down laser, especially in the inferior 6 clock hours if I don't need to, because there's nothing worse than having to later lift up retina off of old laser scars to try to do a retinectomy if you have to. And find it caught, and you end up with these pegs of peripheral retina that's kind of nasty and necrotic and stuck down. And then you're like, well, if I pull on it, like Dean Elliott says, I'm going to get a bleed, and then I'll be sad. And if I leave it, then I'm leaving these stumps of retina that probably are not great for the PVR drive going forward. So you can answer anything anyone else said, but let's go back to that PVR discussion. I mean, how would you answer something? Like, I'm asking you now, like, don't you think that having some mobility inferiorly is nice if you do need to approach PVR in the future?
I tend not to worry about it, actually. And I think there's two things associated with this. I think the first is going back to your prior question is where to put the laser. And I think I like you, always straddle the vitreous space. I make sure, even as a posterior vitreous space for my 360 laser, to have shots behind it and then up to the aura. And then once that's there, I think that next time, you know, when I needed to perform a retinectomy, I don't think that, first of all, it makes me waste the real estate, and I'm losing real estate because I always want to make that retinectomy posterior to wherever that vitreous space was, so I know where it is. And then it becomes the starting point for where that retinectomy needs to go. I haven't personally found, in having done a fair number of reoperations in the patients that I have done surgery for, I haven't found elevating that lasered anterior retina to be a big concern personally. Maybe it's the style of the laser I do. I go for gray, moderately spaced burns that are not confluent. I think that, even if there's a little bit of retina left over here, I don't think It is a huge drive for PVR. I haven't seen that personally. And again, this is all anecdotes. And then the final question is like, does the laser itself create the risk for more inflammation in PVR? And I just feel like anecdotally, I haven't seen personally that feeling. I mean, you know, surgery, I feel like for me is all about the feeling. Do I feel like this happened afterwards? Does that really feel that way? And to me, I just don't detect that. I'm searching my soul. I've searched my soul a lot because it's a huge question. And I haven't detected that. And I feel like if I did, I would not do it.
Well, this is why retina meetings are so great, because I think we all sort of at the end come down to that gut feeling. Like you said, surgery is all a feeling because we don't have good enough data, but then we all feel something differently. And then we're trying to figure out what the right answer is. And inevitably the right answer is whatever you think works best in your hands, you should probably do. Any thoughts on that PVR concept or other thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I think David brings up some great points. And I think, again, it kind of, like you said, a lot of it goes back to your gut. I like to think that I could rescue most, you know, PVR detachments if I've just done a bit with a buckle. I like to think that for most cases, I could add a buckle and avoid retinectomy. Obviously, that's not always the case. I think in the cases of mine, at least, where I've done 360 laser, and then I've tried to rescue with a buckle, it ends up being insufficient. And I end up having to do some form of a retinectomy anyway. And again, like you said, this is just anecdotal. But I agree that I feel like I have the ability to peel peripheral membranes on less friable retina if it hasn't been previously lasered. And that's part of the reason I think that if I'm considering PVR in the future, I would avoid lasering the inferior 6 o'clock hours.
So, you know, we all like to go with our gut. I have found that when I go back and actually look at my numbers, you know, how many have redetached and just, you know, take my feelings out of it almost a little bit, I do tend to overemphasize and remember the ones that did redetach. And, you know, we all tend to forget about the ones that went great and, you know, you didn't even think about it. So what did you do in those cases and taking a look back? But also, we're retina surgeons. We do laser all the time. We laser entire retinas for PDR. And so really, we're talking about in this setting where you have bare RPE or you are liberating RPE and you have subretinal fluid and there's something else different. Obviously, we're not seeing massive PVR when you're lasering, you know, for a vitreous hemorrhage and diabetes, or I hope not, you know. And so what is going on in that setting specifically with the laser? And I do think it can be PVR-genic because it is inflammatory and maybe, you know, focusing on that gray burn over white, focusing on the big burn over the small, you know, those small hot burns liberate those RPE cells. They're causing that micro breaks with the subretinal fluid. So I think mechanistically, it makes sense that it would cause, you know, a higher incidence of PVR. And so that could be an argument against, or it could be an argument to just do it the correct way that Dr. Ryan and you suggest in the study, you know, have these gray burns and kind of do it that way.
Yeah. And I think the one thing none of us are referencing, because I mean, we just don't encounter that often. The real question comes during the actual surgery. What if the view just goes in the pisser? And then the question is, what's the risk benefit of throwing laser that you can't properly evaluate the heat, the temperature, the location versus not doing it? And my argument for my fellows always is like, if you really can't see it and there's no pathology there, just treat the breaks and get out, because there's nothing worse than you can do than doing it improperly. Even David, who's the most ardent 360 laser on this call, would agree it's probably worse if you're throwing in hot burns all over the place that don't have a place and you can't evaluate those during the surgery. So in general, if you can't see, then And that's why I always have the fellows treat the breaks first. I was like, go ahead and treat the breaks, and then you can do the 360 laser after. And I actually have a really, really low threshold to pass the 360 laser. Actually, I'm much more likely to pass the breaks. But because the 360 laser, to me, that temperature and that location is so important, unless I develop a good trust or I get a sense that they can control and titrate that well, that's actually one of the last things I'll pass. I usually will do that myself. And David, you're not. I don't know if you feel the same way.
I definitely agree. I think that it's technically challenging for people who are learning. I think that, you know, for pseudophakes that where we're doing that, I do laser under air. I generally do drainage retinotomies and I don't laser under perfluorine. So, you know, but I have a pretty good set of tricks to manage my view under air. I think that, but you still have to be speedy about it. You just cannot laddie-daddle while you are under air. And I totally agree. I couldn't agree more about treating the breaks first, prioritizing those. And for me, again, to echo what I just said, I mean, the goal is to prevent a missed break. And if you're going to laser hot, you're just going to create a break. That'd be the opposite. And I want to parlay this into sort of my thinking, just going back to what you said, actually, about PVR. And I think that a lot of times that what I sort of always thought was the holy grail was an extensive peel up to the periphery. But I think over time, I'm sort of a pro retinectomy kind of guy as well. And I just think that, you know, the times I've seen that there's PVR, I think that the intrinsic foreshortening component of it can never be successfully or adequately treated by surface peeling. And I think surface peeling can only take you so far. I definitely agree that placing a buckle on for a reoperation, if there wasn't one initially, is a good way to do it. But if I get the sense that the retina is stiffened and foreshortened and stuff, you know, I think usually for me, my go-to there is to perform that extensive peel. I almost always peel ILM when I see some membrane, or if it's a chronic RD or there's baseline PVR, whatever else. But I do that if it wasn't, you know, my first operation or something like that. And then we treat the peripheral membranes, and then I perform a retinectomy oftentimes.
You know, so, and we're going to move on to the next article, but the last thing I'll say to that subject, I think, David, we're both biased by where we trained. I think we trained at a place where we did a lot of retinectomies, and we got comfortable, and our attendings were more pro-retinectomy. And what I've encountered, you know, coming back here, I think, you know, a lot of things here aren't as pro-retinectomy, and I think there's reasons. You know, retinectomies have their pros, and they definitely work, and they're really valuable, and they're very efficient way to attach the retina and do it well, especially if you don't have the opportunity to add a buckle or do other things. But I will say that there are obviously disadvantages if you look at literature, hypotonia being one of them, chronic issues with that. But yeah, you're preaching the choir here. Akshay and Nick, you know, having trained at other institutions, may feel differently. Nick wants to make a point about that.
Just that in a retinectomy, you're using confluent laser at the edge of it, aren't you? And so you're trusting it there to lay the retina down, keep it down. You know, are you extrapolating that to the rest of the retina then?
I'm trying to think. I paint the edge, but I also sometimes will throw an interrupted row depending on how much room I have. I don't know. I kind of hedge because people argue whether confluent or interrupted laser is better. And so sometimes I'll hedge if there's a break. Well, I'll paint the break and then I'll put like a row around it. So I have both. So if one is better than the other, then at least I've kind of waffled and done both. But again, Dave, I don't know. You're probably a mix of both because I think we had attendings who did both.
Yeah, I think that the continuous laser is more efficient when you're doing retinectomy, you know, because the width of it is generally going to be controlled and consistent. You're not, you know, treating a variable sized vitreous base. So it's a lot more efficient. It's one of the reasons I prefer it. But I have heard anecdotally from other surgeons the thing that, you know, they get a redetachment and the entire thing lifted at the posterior edge of the retinectomy, horror stories, and that can happen with overly hot laser from especially continuous laser.
Let's move on to the next case because we spent a while talking about this. This is also surgical. So this is just a case presentation by Leila Bazovich to a panel, including Tim Murray, Peter Kaiser, Arshad Khanani, Christina Wang, about a recurrent myopic macular hole. And again, you can go read about the case. I thought that it's just an interesting conversation because they have this conversation about this patient had a macular buckle and a myopic hole and had multiple surgeries. And they're coming for like a fifth operation at this point. And they're like talking about all the different things they should do. Should they do a free flap or autologous transplant or suprachoroidal helon? And in the end, I mean, this is the reason we always stay in. There was residual ILM ERM. They just peeled that and the hole closed. So I guess actually, I mean, you trained at Duke, so you know Leila well. And you guys, I think a lot of people from Duke have talked about approaching these myopic holes in different ways. You know, autologous graft, blood, you know, autologous blood, free flaps. What's your go-to, right? So like, if you have a hole that just won't close, especially a myope, and this patient, the myopia was sort of corrected. The staphyloma is really not bad because they have a macular buckle under, but let's say they don't have a macular buckle. Are you adding a macular buckle? What is kind of your go-to now that you're in practice, if you have a fourth or fifth, you know, operation patient coming for a second opinion?
Yeah, great question. So first off, I'd say my macular buckle N is an N of two, one in fellowship and one in practice. And
I remember that is infinitely more macular buckles than I've done. unless one of my buckles is like posterior at some point.
I remember both of them well because they were both extremely, extremely painful cases. Okay. I'd say macular buckling is not currently in my armamentarium. I'd say the first thing, it depends on the morphology of the hole. If it's like the one that Leila presented, which has cystic edges, a small hole, I think I would do very similar to what she did, which is I just peel more ILM. I'd probably do an ILM free flap. There's very little to lose from doing it. I've done a handful of autologous retinal transplants for large holes, especially if they're large, recurrent with associated detachments. But my go-to would be to just peel more ILM, use an ILM-free flap under perfluoron, and then use a longer-acting gas tamponade.
Nice. Nick?
So, you know, Akshay and I didn't train at the same place, but we did train near each other. And so I did get to hear him talk about autologous retinal transplants when it was just coming out as one of the fathers of that technique. Oh. I like to give you plenty of credit. But I
did throw the stitches for all those cases. I just want to tell you right now.
Well, speaking of stitches, did anyone else catch that Dr. Murray says no one sutures anymore in this article?
I'd like to go ahead and say I do suture, and you know, when needed, especially in leaky, but in high myopes with that thin sclera, I would say I'm much, much more likely to suture, but maybe I just like to play it safe. I do think going back to the article, they mentioned irrigating underneath the retina using hydrodissection. Somebody mentioned using a viscoelastic, some use BSS, but I have heard and have used that technique in a recurrent macular hole. I do think when you look at this article, the picture is interesting because is the macular buckle creating a morphology that's actually reopening the hole? And they all chose to leave the macular buckle. Again, my N of zero with macular buckling would show that I don't have the, I guess, experience or knowledge to tell you is that how much that's contributing and whether I would ever dare to remove a macular buckle that had been there that long and the scarring and the issues may be inherent there. So I do think hydrodissection is an interesting point, bringing those edges together, using a flex loop to even kind of shift that macular hole together. Yeah. And I remember at VBS, I think about 4 years ago, somebody presented on using a 39 gauge cannula to slowly get the fluid out of the hole. I'm not in favor of draining from the actual macular hole standardly, but they presented this as a way to not disrupt the RPE, not disrupt that area. And you can actually watch the macular hole close on the table that way. And I thought those were all pretty good, interesting points, as well as remembering to find out how big your eye is. This was a 34 millimeter eye, I think it was. And so making sure that their instruments actually reached, lowering the IOP so you can indent the sclera, though that will change your viewpoint. I thought were all good points.
You know, there's so many. And David, I'm curious what you guys think. You show a hands. I mean, did anyone look at that OCT and be like, I'm not actually that worried that it's going to close? Like, I was kind of surprised. I mean, I understand that the buckle's booking, but I was kind of like, that looks like it. When I read the article, myopic recurrent macular hole, I was expecting this monster huge thing in the staphylum. And I'm looking at this, I'm like, you know, there's many reasons this could have not closed. Residual ILM, ERN, underfill. You know, Dr. Murray brought up the point. A lot of these eyes end up underfilled because they have thin sclera. You don't suture, and then they're underfilled. And this is, you know, I'm not a big prone positioner, but this is this case where if you did have a staphyloma in a big eye, that probably the prone positioning matters the most. Now, you can argue with gas. Is the surface tension affected because the gas is filling the container completely? But it's no longer a sphere if you have a staphyloma. So there is maybe an argument that could matter, and I probably would err in a patient who's had this many surgeries of doing face down like they did for a week. You know, Nick, for me, if I had looked at this case, I don't know if I would have jumped straight to a transplant if I hadn't done the previous surgeries. I might have done stained, right, and done brushed the edges together like you talked about, and that probably would have been sufficient to close. In this case, they just peeled it, put gas, and it closed. David, what's your go-to? So let's recreate that scenario and the thing I thought I would see when I looked at the first picture, which is this gaping 750 micron hole and a myope. You've done a surgery, it didn't close. What is your go-to at this point? Are you on Camp Akshay?
I will admit that I have not done an autologous retinal transplant. So
you've got to do it. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, I can comment, and he's probably seen or done more than me. It's actually not as technically difficult as you would think. And I'm not saying that to minimize what we do. And I use we very loosely because I've done very fewer other people. A lot of people have done way more than me. Mm-hmm. But it's not a technically difficult procedure, especially if you stage it. I think if you didn't stage it, it becomes more technically difficult. But continue.
Well, I think that it's mechanistically more ideal if you move and close the native retina. And I would probably reserve a more aggressive procedure in cases where we're talking about not just one failure, but two or more failures. And so when there is a large first failure, I do tend to do an adjunctive procedure, whether it's doing a free flap, because generally, if it was my RIA, you know, I do a moderate peel, and there'd be no opportunity to bring a hinged flap over there. In cases where that proves to be difficult, or you know, it looks like truly it's a very good peel and everything, I do the BSS plebs. I use a subretinal cannula, a 41 gauge cannula that we have in our institution, and I make three plebs, inferiorly, superiorly, and temporally. And then you know, I bring it over, and you can usually use visualization, just direct visualization. If you have OCT, that can be another adjunctive technique too, just to confirm. But you can sort of visualize the sides of this hole having some mass effect where it's actually pushing the edges together. The flex loop technique, I think, is another one that you can also bring over either in that same situation or without even doing the fluid at all. So those are some of my go-tos.
And you know, I people use a flex loop, and that's great. I actually prefer using a soft tip for that. I'll use a soft tip cannula. I think it's a little gentler with a silicone tip, and then it's nice because you're going to maybe use it for the fluid air exchange anyway, and you can kind of gently just brush. But I think it's the same principle. Some people use a Tano, and it's the same kind of concept. Let's move forward because we have a couple more articles I want to cover. So the next article is by Chris Riemann and Nathaniel Riemann on this custom flex iris prosthesis. They're essentially showing this iris prosthesis that's been approved in the US 3 years ago and kind of been lost in the shuffle. I don't feel like we're doing a whole lot of these. I personally have not done one. I'm curious to see if you guys have either seen this or done it. But it's kind of a cool procedure, right? They talk about how it's in place. You can do it in the sulcus without sutures. You can put it in the sulcus with suture fixation, kind of similar to like a Gore-Tex suture IOL is what I've heard. And, you know, again, it just seems like there aren't that many of these done. And probably some of this is because a lot of these are being done by the anterior segment people. I know at least one person here at Bascom who does them. But, you know, I think this is a bugaboo, Akshay, about iris. So sometimes we have iris defects that are traumatic, and that's hopefully most of them. Some of them are, they're iatrogenic, and there's an iris defect that's there because we'll say the fellow, even though it might have been one of us, the fellow took a nom, and there's a little defect in the iris now. You know, I feel like we don't do a ton of conversation as retina specialists about iris repair and iris prosthesis. And again, probably because anterior segment people dominate this discussion, but it's actually really relevant, right? Because I can feel a lot of times we're referred these patients, are managing them, we're putting a secondary IOL. It's kind of nice for the patient not to have to have multiple procedures. I'm just curious, you know, any tips or tricks for fellows or young attendings who have to manage iris defects and kind of the basics they should know what to do?
Well, I'll preface it. I do have one experience with the with this iris implant, and that's fishing it out of the vitreous cavity along with the CTR and an IOL. So that was an in-bag placement in an aneuritic patient. And as you can imagine, trying to remove that entire complex is not very fun. But I can't think honestly of a patient that I've personally had that would have clearly benefited from it. I'd say the majority of my patients that have really poor iris tissue are uveitics, since that's a sizable portion of my practice, and I would never put anything in their eye unless it absolutely needed to be there. The only bit of advice is that I'm doing a lot more anterior segment stuff than I would have expected as a retina surgeon. I think honestly in fellowship, I didn't do a ton of secondary IOL placements just because our anterior segment department did a lot of it. So I think we fished the lenses out and then they put the lenses in. So I think I've had to learn a lot more. And I will say that, you know, obviously that changes just from year to year, but at least in my personal experience, but I've had to learn a lot, I think, during my first couple of years of practice, including, you know, repairing iris defects and stuff like that. So there's a learning curve and you need, unfortunately, some very understanding, not high maintenance patients to learn on as we do in our training. So it's just a tool you have to pick up, hopefully, in training.
Do you think, like, if we were playing a game of Never Have I Ever, Akshay would be, you would either be winning or losing now, depending on how we were scoring this. I have never picked up one of these from the eye or taken one out, but I will concede there. Nick, any other thoughts on iris repair?
So they talk a lot about using this in trauma, and in that situation, you know, they talked about three different places you can put this in the bag, like Akshay was saying, but in the sulcus, which they really didn't like without sutures, and then suturing into the sulcus. I thought one of their points, you know, they say just basically do it the same time you're suturing a scleral IOL, but they're using the same sclerotomy. So you've already got the Gore-Tex through there, let's say, for your lens of choice. Let's say you did an Acrios, and then you're doing a handoff technique for another Gore-Tex suture. It seemed to me like you have a lot, you have, you know, multiple things going through the sclerotomy now. I'm now worried I've kind of rubbed up against my previous Gore-Tex suture, created some sort of traction there. I've got to still rotate both of these knots now through the same, and, you know, and then are these going to leak and cause hypotony? I have not done one of these again. Akshay, you win that one, but
I've played zero.
He just took one out.
He's had it in his hand. So, you know, in my hands, I have not done one of these, but that's what I was thinking through. But I do think in a trauma patient who has lost a lot of their iris and is quite symptomatic and photophobic, I do think it sounds great. I think it sounds like a great alternative, you know, and they weighed the pros and cons of whether you could use a contact lens, a colored contact lens and things like that, and not putting anything near the angle that could cause issues as this is the only FDA approved treatment. I haven't done it. I could see a place for it, but it's still, I'd like to see it done.
Dave, thoughts on this before we move forward?
I think that there's the piece from the retina standpoint, I think, is important, which is like, what are we responsible for? Which I echo what everyone else here is saying, which is this sort of remains predominantly the territory of the anterior segment surgeon. There's one or two surgeons in my community over here who are very good at doing this. My one patient that we're in the process of referring, and he's in the process of getting this lens. What I was responsible for is as part of just putting in oil, taking out oil, he got a tube in the eye as part of the second surgery. The only thing I was asked to do as the retina surgeon was to confirm that iris stump, and this is a post-traumatic patient, really was not amenable at all. It had contracted and scarred so much. It was not amenable to a pupillary cerclage. And so I took a max grip and I just pulled at the iris 360 degrees actually through, you know, some of the incisions, and we confirmed that it was completely atrophic. It was stuck down. There's no way that it, you know, the thing was stuck out at 11 millimeters or so. There's just no way that there was any other way. And then I think the other piece is that the article talked about a couple of other different ways to kind of get this symptomatic control. I mean, one is cosmesis and the other is like symptomatic control. I think there's also these, I don't know if they're in production anymore. I've heard about them. I think they're made by a company called Morture. And they're like basically these like blacked out CTRs that have a big paddle shape and you can put them in the bag or in the sulcus and they can help recreate a pupil for you and get rid of glare. Although not necessarily the cosmesis side of things. And then one other tidbit, I have seen the anterior segment surgeon who is very good in our community who did do a combination to address your point, Nick. His technique, and I'm not advocating this, but just to throw another angle to it, was to actually on the side table, actually first suture an MX60 lens that was intended to go in first to the prosthesis. So you turn this into one big bulky thing that was then inserted and then one set of sutures. I think, I'm not sure if it was, it's probably, I imagine attached to the iris prosthesis, probably easier, which was then scleral fixated with Gore-Tex.
And was foldable as one?
So I think the thing to keep in mind is this thing's like almost 13 millimeters. It never folds that much. Having just sort of seen it done again, I've never touched one of these with my hands or anything. So I think a larger, more generous incision, whether it's a scleral tunnel or it's, you know, it's a corneal incision, so something to consider.
Great point.
Great. Let's quickly cover. We went way over just talking about that first article, but that was kind of the design. And the last this article, just briefly touch on. There's this article about Raj Upday. And all talking about Alzheimer's and OCT and OCTA biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. I think this is something, if you haven't heard about it, it's worth reading. Duke has done a lot of work in this. I think Sharon Feckert came and talked a little bit about this on the podcast and WashU is also looking at this. I mean, I think that this is cool. I mean, it's interesting. It's something none of us learned about in medical school, but it does make some sense. Maybe it makes sense in one sense, but it doesn't make sense in another sense, but that they're retina manifestations of systemic disease are there, and Alzheimer's is a systemic disease, or at least a systemically neurologic disease. So it'd be manifested in neural tissue, which is retinal tissue as well. You know, for me, Akshay, it's the thing that's curious what they touch on is can really what people want to know, what would a patient want to know is, can you predict who will get Alzheimer's based on their retinal findings? Because that's obviously way easier to do than to either wait for MRI findings, at which point it's usually too late, and B, you can't biopsy the brain, but you can do optical biopsy with OCT or OCTA. Obviously, the second part of that, which is always the ethical question, is even if you knew someone was going to get it, could you do anything about it? But this is also really going to be relevant. Is can you stratify risk? But it seems like that could be potentially it. The thing we don't know, right, is how early in the pre-cognitive decline do these findings emerge, and if they emerge early enough to pick this up. But what sort of insider information can you give us from your Duke Mafia connections?
Not much. But first, you know, hats off to Dilraj and Dr. Fekrad. I think their study was really well done. But it's tricky, right? Because the signs are kind of, you know, nonspecific, right? If you talk about, you know, generalized volume loss or decrease, you know, vascular density, you know, these are not things that are isolated to any one particular disease, right? And that's kind of the earliest, you know, the big concern I have. I think what's interesting, though, at this point, especially for Alzheimer's disease, is with, you know, this new biologic being recently FDA approved, which is in itself this whole big controversy, but this new biologic being approved for Alzheimer's is whether there's some detectable change with use of this medication on your retinal vascular findings. Because I think if these hypotheses are true, that these amyloid plaques are depositing retinal capillaries and they're causing, you know, ischemia and dropout and loss, then is any of that reversible? Do you actually see a reversal with this medication? So I think for me, that'll be the most interesting thing to see as this medication comes out to the market, if it comes to the market.
David or Nick?
So I think that's a great point. So, you know, one of the of early disease detection is, you know, are you seeing any effect from therapy? To your point, if you could detect it early, you know, would you do anything? With these patients, it's also about family planning and, you know, do you have a plan down the line? So I do think there is a benefit if we could do that. The interesting part of this article is it really said when they looked at the preclinical Alzheimer patients, those who had biomarkers such as on PET scan, or the CSF, the amyloid beta protein, it wasn't statistically significant. They had some evidence that the FAZ increased and some that it actually decreased, and they hypothesized it was due to inflammation and, you know, were we just catching the disease at a different state? I think that is definitely, that'd be great to have in the future, you know, where we could have early diagnosis that could lead to planning, that could lead to some forethought. And obviously, then you'd want to see disease modification and evidence that therapy is working. I have definitely been asked by patients if we can do this and if it's going to help. And I don't think, like you were saying, I how do we rule out everything else going on that, you know, in these diabetic hypertensive patients that can change our capillary thickness and density in our FAZ. I don't think we're there yet, but it's pretty exciting to know that we have kind of a trail to follow.
David, I'm going to date myself right now because I'm going to put on my Gene Hackman and Enemy of the State hat and be the paranoid one. So the dark side of all of this, right, is that you can now get more and more information about people from things that we previously thought were not identifying, right? So we fundus photos, we never really got permission to take fundus photos and show them in conferences and put them on Instagram and just share them with our colleagues on text threads. But, you know, now you can tell somebody's, you know, based on some imaging finding, maybe you can tell the risk for developing Alzheimer's. We aren't there yet, but that could be in the horizon. You can tell someone's gender. There's artificial intelligence programs, deep learning programs that have figured out you can tell gender. You can maybe tell ethnicity and demographics and disease susceptibility, diabetes, things like that. More and more information can be derived from something that we thought was very, very simple, which is great because it means our field is way richer and more complex. But the dark side, so that the Gene Hackman paranoid, you know, the government's out to get us kind of thing would be, you know, what are the protections that would have to exist? Like, I can imagine an insurance company would be highly interested to know whether, you know, God forbid Nick Farber is going to develop dementia. Maybe we don't want to insure him or we raise his premium because we know based on his FA that he did 5 years ago that he had to disclose that, you know, there's a subtle finding. I mean, so what I'm curious, you're someone who has an IT background. What do you think about how information is going to be protected as more and more information can be dug up from things we thought were pretty innocuous?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely a consideration, especially because we have hordes of raw data about, you know, with OCT data for all the patients that we treat. I think that's definite concern. You know, I think that this is definitely something that we have to sort of, I don't know, pursue from an ethical standpoint and sort of come to an ethical conclusion maybe, or at least open discussions in our community as a whole. I think that's sort of where we have to, I guess, base it off of. And I don't know what the nature of these discussions are, and and sort of what ultimately our standpoint is, but I think that it's important for us as ophthalmologists, as retina specialists, to have one.
Any closing thoughts, guys? We went way over. You guys were awesome. Actually, do you want to do a quick plug for the one that has superseded this podcast as the best retina podcast to listen to if you're trying to learn your retina?
Oh my God. Yeah. So not a retina podcast. We would never want to live in your shadow. But Laura Coquelin and I recently started a uveitis podcast called Headlight on the Fog. We just have a couple episodes out, but I think it's been a great learning tool for me. Kind of forces us to stay sharp and do a lot more lit review before doing these little interviews. So yeah, check it out if you have some time.
Headlight in the Fog, great title, and in the App Store, Android Store, definitely subscribe. Guys, David Chu, Nick Farber, and Akshay Thomas, thanks so much for your time, and I'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
As always, you can find this podcast episode and all other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. All 310 episodes, including this one, can be found there sort of by category. In addition, you'll find links to subscribe and receive updates on the latest episodes as they show up in your email inbox. Remember, we're in the Apple Podcast and Android Podcast app on the mobile devices. You can also find us on Twitter and on Facebook at Retina Podcast. We really love feedback, so if you can give us feedback in the App Store or send an email with episode ideas, what you like, what you'd like to see more of, please let us know. There is a contact us link on our website, and again, the email directly is retinapodcast@gmail.com. Many thanks to Drs. Farber, Chu, and Thomas for joining for this podcast episode. Thanks to Jen Ford and the team at PenTivision for providing the articles in advance of publication. Thanks to Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Venacasa for preparing this episode and accompanying social media. This is Jay Schreeder signing off by wishing you, the listeners, a great day, and thanking you for the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here, and the patients you take care of each week. Take care.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.